Welcome to the Moral and Ethical Leadership Podcast, hosted by the BYU Management Society Salt Lake Chapter. I'm Dave Austin.
And I'm Kurt Frankum.
Wow, we hope you're all safe and healthy during this incredibly difficult time. We've been doing this podcast for about a year with our monthly luncheon speakers. And due to the crisis that we're currently in, the multiple crises that we're currently in, we want to change it up a little bit. We want to start a new guest series called Voices of Light.
We know there are a lot of people suffering out there right now, whether it is physically, emotionally, or economically, and our hope is to bring you guests who can uplift, inspire, and have honest conversations with us. We'd like to have guest interviews on a somewhat regular basis, and hopefully this can help us all get through this together.
And we're so blessed to have someone with us today who needs no introduction, Mrs. Ann Romney. Ann, welcome, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And as we mentioned, this is an incredibly difficult time in our country and around the world. How are you doing personally, and how's your family holding up?
Well, we're doing probably just about like everyone else. We've been safe so far. No one has gotten sick. We are all isolating. I have 5 sons and 25 grandchildren. I have heard word that my older grandkids are not social distancing. And so I think they've had enough of that, and they're with their friends again. So we'll see how that goes. But they've been, all of them have been really isolated for the last 3 months. And I haven't seen them. So this has been the longest stretch. I have not seen my children ever since I gave birth to them. And my oldest son is 50 years old. So this has been a real trial for me not to be with my children or my grandchildren. And my Josh, number 3 son, had a new baby, which right at the beginning of COVID, and I haven't seen that baby yet either, which is hard.
Mm. My parents, my wife's parents just got back from a mission in Nauvoo, and we still haven't seen them, and they got back 3 months ago. So it's a hard time. It's hard to know what to do.
Well, we have a grandson in Rome, and he was in, I think, 100 days in his apartment. And he's out and about now, but not a lot. And he can't really teach, can't go into homes. So I'm sure a lot of the missions, another granddaughter was on a mission in Chile, and she came home. And so she's waiting to go back out again right now. But, you know, everyone's lives have been disrupted. There's no question that economically, socially, mentally, it's been tough.
Yeah. How would you say your husband, as being a senator, that there's a lot of travel involved there? Does he have any routines that help him manage and keep safe?
Well, he actually, the Senate state, he was with me for, I would say, maybe 6 weeks where he was only doing Zoom meetings. And so he was conducting business, but he wasn't actually physically in Washington, D.C. And that was kind of nice in a way. We enjoyed that. It was busy for him. He was on Zoom all day long. He is in D.C. again. I'm sure people have been watching the news, too. It's hard to miss some of the comments he's been making and some of the things he's been doing. You know, it brought a lot of attention to him again. But I think all in a good way, in a way that magnifies his priesthood, frankly, that he is showing love for his fellow man. And at a time where people are feeling isolated and you know, he's been able to speak up and say, love is the answer. And we need to all care for one another.
Yeah. And that's so important to remember that, and to remember the importance of unity during times like this. One of the things that I've always been so impressed with you, Anne, is just how strong your family is. And can you talk to us a little bit about how to maintain strong family ties? How have you done it throughout your life? How have you done it in your family and maintain such strong family ties?
Well, before COVID, we saw each other a lot. Mitt and I made a point of seeing the grandchildren and children all of the time. And then we had family vacations together, but we make real effort to get together. During COVID, we've held Sunday Zoom meetings and had our own church services with our Come Follow Me program. and our different grandchildren sort of leading those sessions. And we've stayed in touch that way. I have to say, though, I really, really miss them. Yeah. Not physically being able to be with them and see them. So I think, you know, those of us that I'm 71, and, you know, I have multiple sclerosis, so I'm high risk. So, you know, it's important that both Mitt and myself stay isolated. Mitt's got a tougher job of being isolated because he is in the Senate. He wears a mask and he, you know, is being careful, but he's exposed to more people than I am right now.
You know, you mentioned that you know, the MS that you experience and struggle with, you know, in your book, you suggested that MS was been one of the greatest blessings of your life. And maybe at times like this, that's, you know, when there's even a higher risk of ailments and things, knowing the debilitating effects of MS and how you discussed the significant battle, which you have had facing the utter fatigue and literally stopping your ability to even open an envelope. Can you maybe explain your illness and how it's become an incredible blessing to you?
Yeah, so I certainly wouldn't have thought it was when I was first diagnosed, nor the first few years of it, because I was in such, you know, poor health and it was so difficult for me. But it has been my greatest teacher. And so knowing how, what despair I went into and how I thought my life was over, I thought there was never going to be another good day. I couldn't stand not being who I was before, and I had to figure out my new identity and figure out what my place was going to be in life again. Those were really, really tough things I was going through for about 3 years. So I would be shocked going back to my old self at the beginning of the disease to say that I would have looked at it as a blessing. I think hardship is a cruel teacher sometimes, and it can be a very effective and good teacher. And it was for me. It was a lot to do with identity. So, you know, I think so many of us define ourselves. I'm a teacher. I'm a lawyer. I'm a judge. I'm a stockbroker. And, you know, we really identify sort of our strengths and our abilities through how the world sees us. And then when you have the rug pulled out from underneath you, and I, you know, looked at myself as being this really capable person that could handle everything and was running this and running that, and all of a sudden I couldn't do anything, you're left with, who am I? What's my identity? And what of what worth am I at all? And that was a really tough thing I had to go through, where I felt worthless and not important, and I couldn't be of use to anyone. I was going to be a burden. And so I had to strip everything away and get right down to the core of who you are as a person, and know that God loves you for who you are, not for how the world sees you. And so it's, again, trying to find a new identity, and then finding strength in that identity and finding peace in that identity. So I think those that are going through struggles have to know, when they finally peel all those outer layers away, that at the core, we are what God sees and what God loves. And there's such value in that. And I think we're going through that right now with the Black Lives Matter. You see this, is that every person is of value and is loved by our Father in heaven. So again, you know, it comes right back to the same thing, which is love and how God sees us and the value that we have, and we are of that essence. So having gone through all of that, it really did teach me to have, obviously, more compassion, a greater understanding for eternal worth, a greater understanding, honestly, for the atonement, for understanding that struggles sometimes, I mean, not most times, are what life is about, And that was my particular struggle. Everyone has their own struggle. We do not escape this life without having to have our own struggle. That's what mine was. I didn't like it when I was going through it. Now, I have come out the other end, and I'm doing really well, and I've got my feet on the ground again, and I've got strength, and I'm not sick right now. I'm in remission. So at this point, for me, where the place I am is trying to figure out now, how can people lean on me? Because I need the shoulder to lean on during those really dark days. And now it's my turn for people to lean on me. And that's sort of the evolution of how I started the Ann Romney Center, and am trying to find a way to make sure that people that are out there that are going through the same struggles I was going through will have hope that there's a lot of people working right now to find relief for those that are suffering.
And talk a little bit about the Ann Romney Center. That was one of the questions I was going to ask. And what is that, and how does that work? And it's at Brigham and Women's, is that correct?
It's at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. It is a research center. We study multiple sclerosis, Alzheimer's, ALS, Parkinson's, and brain tumors. And so we have 350 researchers, and they are working, obviously, in all those different disease areas, but they also are collaborating amongst themselves, but also collaborating with different universities and research centers around the world. So part of my initiative when we started this, and Mitt was particularly, with being a strategic planner that he is, he said, look, this, we have to share the research. We can't, be selfish about anything we're finding out. We have to make sure and collaborate. And so we do. We collaborate all across with many different research centers in the United States and in Europe. That's what we're about. We have our own physical facility in Boston, right next to the Brigham and Women's Hospital. We have our own building. It is very exciting. It's Harvard Medical School affiliated. So honestly, we have the best and the brightest, and we are making breakthroughs. There is breakthroughs happening with multiple sclerosis. There are a lot of treatments right now for MS, but not treatments for progressive MS. And we're making breakthroughs for progressive MS. We are making breakthroughs in ALS. We're finding some treatments that are under review right now, and we're starting human trials for some ALS medication. We are finding some breakthroughs in Alzheimer's, which is one of the toughest things to crack. And there's nothing right now, really, that anyone can take to put off that terrible disease. But our brilliant doctor, Dr. Howard Weiner, has developed a nasal vaccine for Alzheimer's, which goes into human trials this year. I don't know. It was supposed to go in by late summer. I don't know with COVID if it's still going to happen. I'm assuming it will, but where you will literally be able to take a vaccine and prevent yourself from having Alzheimer's. So we've got a lot of things that are happening. We're very excited about it. It will take years, of course, of research and effort. But that was one way where I wanted to be able to give back. And when Mitt lost the presidency in 2012, I was speaking with Dr. Howard Weiner, who was one of the top researchers in the world with MS. And I said, you know, Mitt lost, but maybe there's something we can still do. I would have been, as First Lady, had a much bigger platform to have helped you promote some of the research that you're doing. And I said, well, let's do it anyway, and let's see where we go. So it's become a very famous center already. There are, everyone knows about it, and there are a lot of people that are reaching out all the time that want to get a position there because it's already got quite a fantastic reputation.
Wow, that's inspiring. I mean, and as an individual, sometimes that when we don't have a loved one that's close to us that's battling this every day, we sort of lose perspective of the progress is happening. But it sounds like some great progresses there. And if somebody does want to get involved or learn more, I'm sure you have online resources and places to contribute and whatnot, but is there other ways that people could get involved in what you're doing?
Well, we have a wonderful website, and especially for people that are suffering from any of these neurologic diseases, there is a platform for people to be able to share their stories and share, their concerns. So that there's that aspect of it. Of course, there's the research aspect of it as well. But there's also the ability to be able to donate for this research. You can imagine it's quite expensive to be doing all the research we're doing. And I will tell you that the interesting thing about research, the NIH does fund a lot of research, but it funds it at the point where it looks like something is working. And so for what we do, we're trying a lot of out-of-the-box thinking. For instance, this nasal vaccine, I mean, that's really out-of-the-box thinking for Alzheimer's. And that would not get funded by the NIH in initial studies because we'd have to be doing a lot of that work ourselves before we could prove that it's worthy of NIH dollars. So there's just to fund the beginning parts of all these ideas that these brilliant doctors have, it just takes money and money that, is not available unless it's being given by donors. So that's one area where I work on is raising funds to fund some of these really out of the box ideas that could end up, really changing the world.
And I want to go back a little bit to your talking about MS and your original diagnosis. I just think that's so powerful. Everybody, as you mentioned, is going through a trial in their life. Some, I heard a good quote that some are more obvious and some are less obvious, but everybody, all of us are going through something. And if we treat each person like they're going through a crisis, we'll be right half the time. I'm just wondering if you can maybe talk a little bit about when you received the diagnosis and the original diagnosing doctor suggesting that without knowing the next best steps for you, he recommended waiting until things got worse. In your mind, you were probably already beyond worse. How did you get past that moment of hopelessness, and how significant was the depression that you suffered?
Well, that was exactly what happened. I got the diagnosis in 1998. There really were not a lot of treatments at that point and not a lot of medications. They did have steroids, but they at that point thought that the best way to treat MS was to wait until you were really bad. They called it the big guns. They didn't want to use the big guns early on. Well, that ended up being totally incorrect. And what you wanted to do, and this is why I got involved with Dr. Howard Weiner. I saw him next. Another person said, you should go see Howard, which was the best thing I ever did in my life. And he said, no, what we have to do is treat you very aggressively at the beginning, which is what he did, which is why I'm here today, being able to do this. But what you go through, again, when you have that rug pulled out from underneath you, is you're like, my life is over. I feel like I'm 80 years old, and I was 50 at that point, and I'm like, I'm never going to have a good day. This is it. I'm finished. And it was pretty rough. I was so sick too. I mean, I really was so fatigued, and it was a foreign, I had moved into a foreign body. I didn't know how to function at all. And I just, I did go through depression, and I totally understand why anybody would. I didn't feel like life was worth living anymore. I didn't want to be a burden to anybody. I wasn't suicidal, but I just didn't want to live at that way. And I was grateful again for the atonement and thinking about the resurrection and all of that. Those things became very poignant. And it's like, oh, I can't wait for that. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, I'm like, I still had to keep living. So I think what happened is family members and my husband in particular just gave me such assurance that no matter what happened, that he was there, that he loved me for who I was, not for what I did. And I think that was the distinction again, where that sort of that you felt that, like, who are you and what makes you tick? And it's like Mitt loved that about me, not the fact that I made good dinners or that I drove the boys all over the place or that I was at the United Way or all those other things that I was doing. That's not what why he loved me. And that's not why God loved me either. So, you know, it's that journey of getting to that point and turning it all over, really turning it all over to Heavenly Father and saying, okay, this is where I am. Now let's make the best of it.
And would you say, like, in that journey, was there a moment or an instance that you can reflect on or remember where it's those feelings of, I can't go on anymore. I don't see how life makes sense after this. Was there a moment where that shifted and hope came in?
Yeah, I think it was really Mitt that did that for me, where he said, I don't care how bad you get. I don't care anything. I'm with you. That's fine. If you're in a wheelchair, I'll be pushing it. So don't you worry. And it was just like, I just gave up the fight of trying to get my old life back at that point, or being who I was, who I thought I was, and just giving it completely up and saying, that's who I am now. This is where I am now. And let's just start with baby steps and just see where this goes. And I think it was, that's when the healing started. It's really when the healing started and just accepting it. And then at that point, trying to figure out how to make the best of it too, like how to get energy that I didn't have, how to eat the right foods. And, you know, that's when I started riding horses and all those different things that started helping me. So, but you have to have something to look forward to in life. You have to have a purpose. You have to have someone to love. And if you don't, those life does become rather grim.
And you are such an inspiration. I know that we're at the end of our time. I want to ask you one more quick question. Today we're supposed to do our luncheon with you and obviously are doing it over podcast instead, and we're so grateful. But do you have any last words of hope for people? My favorite t-shirt is actually from Cotopaxi, and it says do good on it. And I'm just wondering, is there anything you can do good during these perilous times, and any words of encouragement that you have for people who might be listening?
Yeah, you know, I think we are in a most interesting time. Here we had COVID that knocked us all, you know, for a loop. And then just recently, we've had this Black Lives Matter movement and all that, the outpouring that has happened across the world. And to me, that has restored my faith in humanity and my faith in our fellow beings. And again, it comes down to, we have to love one another. That is the greatest commandment that God has given us, is that we have to learn to love one another. And so I look at this as being a very encouraging moment, where I feel like there's been a seismic change in attitude, where people have said, enough of this. We have to do better. And when you are faced with that and recognize that change has to happen, I'm very encouraged by that, because I think there's been a lot of people that have internally changed their behavior and changed their attitudes. So I look at this moment in time as being a very hopeful moment in time.
Well, Anne, you're amazing. Thank you so much. We sure appreciate your time with us, and appreciate you sacrificing to be able to spend time with us and for everything that you're doing and the person that you are. Thank you.
Thank you. I wish I could have been with you. I would have. I can't go anywhere.
June 10th of next year. Well, we've already got it on your calendar. So.
Okay. That would be awesome. I look forward to it already.
All right. And thank you to all of our listeners. We'll be back again next week with a new episode of Voices of Light.